threatened that if she ran, the whole settlement would come after us. And if something happened to me in the pursuit, well, that wasn't Felicity's fault. I turn slowly on Felicity. Her cheeks are bright red. I didn't mean it like that. I was only trying to make Cedra listen to reason. I just wanted her to slow down and let me negotiate with my grandfather. All right, I say. Felicity, please join Petra in staying out of this. You voiced your suspicions. That's enough. Baptiste, your baby is fine. We didn't take her. We're trying to return her. I'm not sure who did take her. We found her with Ellen. And I'm very sorry to say, Ellen is dead. Baptiste freezes, his color draining.
Dead? Which is also not our doing,
Dalton says.
Casey and I were out camping last week. She heard your baby crying and found her under the snow.
What? His eyes round.
Summer was...
She's fine, I say. Ellen had her. She'd rescued her, and she was on the run, and someone killed her. She died clutching Summer to her, keeping her warm. She saved her.
You both saved her, Petra says. You're the one who found the baby before...
She stops, as if realizing Baptiste doesn't need that image.
Before anything happened.
Thank you,
Baptiste says.
I'm not sure how we can ever repay you, but we will. Thank you for finding her, and thank you for finding us. Ellen...
He slumps as the news of her death penetrates the relief at his daughter's survival.
She only wanted to help. She only ever wanted to help. I shouldn't have let her go after Summer. I knew it was dangerous, and we already owed her so much, and I should have said no. I was desperate, and now...
She's gone, Felicity says. Falling apart isn't going to help you find Cedra.
You're soft, Baptiste. Too soft to...
Enough,
Dalton says, the word harsh enough to make Felicity give a start.
A woman is dead, Felicity. A woman who died helping your friends, and Baptiste is allowed a moment to feel bad about that. It isn't weakness. It's called being a fucking human being.
She flinches, and then her face hardens, as if she wants to snap something back. She can't, though. The only comeback would be to accuse him of equal weakness, equal sentimentality. Whatever impression Dalton's made on her, it must not be that. After a moment, she says,
You are right. I am sorry for this woman's death. I'm just concerned about Cedra.
As am I,
Baptiste says.
I don't want to fight over who is more concerned. We both are. Now can we try to find her? Please.
Could you show us the spot where she disappeared? I ask.
Our dog can track scents. He frowns. Again, I'm looking for signs, this time of worry, of panic. I see only confusion, and then surprise, and then relief.
Your dog?
He looks at Storm.
She's a hunting dog?
Just for people, I say. Residents wander into the forest and disappear. She's trained to bring them back.
Eric's the Rockton sheriff, Petra says. Casey is his detective. Finding things is her job. Down south, finding killers was her job.
He doesn't hesitate at that. Again, he looks relieved.
So you'll find who killed Ellen?
Am I certain that's relief? It certainly seems like it. Dalton is watching him with equal care. He's seen the gun. He's figured it out. Is this not the gun that shot Ellen? Or was Cedra the person holding it, and Baptiste knows nothing about that? Or did Baptiste fire it, mistaking Ellen for a hostile, maybe hoping to injure and question one about Summer? So many possibilities. At this point, all I can say is that my gut tells me that if Baptiste is a killer, he's an accidental one, and Lane misunderstood the situation and is covering for him.
Was Cedra taken here?
Dalton says. Startling me from my thoughts as he looks around.
Someone camped here. I'm guessing that was you.
Baptiste frowns and follows Dalton's gaze to the campsite just beyond. He shakes his head.
No, this wasn't us. Not you last night,
Dalton says.
Or not you at all. Not us at all. We have a permanent winter site closer to the mountain with better shelter. This is someone's temporary camp.
Baptiste walks into it and looks around. There's evidence that animals were slaughtered, I say. A hunting camp? Dalton has followed Baptiste, and they're both poking around. After a few minutes, Dalton says,
Overnight camp. They killed their dinner, and maybe a little more to go, but that's it. It isn't the wild people,
Baptiste says.
We haven't seen anyone else in days.
He turns to us.
What if it was a lone hunter who stole Cedra? There are a few of those around. There's a big man who calls himself Cypher. Cedra doesn't like him, so we stay away. There's a younger man, Jacob, who we've traded with.
He turns slowly to Dalton, who's bundled up with a hat and hood, but now he takes a closer look and says,
Oh, yeah, that'd be my brother. I've heard stories. Yes, all right, I don't mean to blame your brother for anything. I just thought, what if a man was hunting and saw Cedra? Jacob's hunting far from here. Tyrone Cypher is in Rockton right now, but yeah, I take your point. Some guy could have been passing through, saw Cedra, and waited for her to leave your shelter last night.
More than one person stayed in this camp, I say. I found multiple boot prints. One isn't much bigger than mine, which suggests a woman. That's why I thought it was your camp. A man and a woman. I trail off.
You thinking what I'm thinking?
Dalton says. I nod. Dalton sighs.
Fuck.
Chapter 39. Who do we think camped here? The couple I accidentally set on Baptiste and Cedra's trail. No, let's be honest. The accident is that I hadn't meant to endanger this young couple, but that's because I'd been thinking abstractly. I offered Charisse an irresistible reward for finding Abby's parents. I just lacked the foresight, in that moment, to see Abby's parents as people who might be endangered by me setting a dangerous woman on that quest. I'd realized my mistake the moment I made the offer, which is why we'd labored to make it ironclad, in hopes of protecting Abby's mother from Charisse's ruthlessness. Even if we'd rescinded it, though, Charisse would know how valuable this information was, and she'd search for Abby's mother in hopes of a reward. The only thing we could do was close off loopholes. It wasn't enough. Earlier, Felicity told me I was wrong for making the offer. She might not have said much more then. She does now. I take my lumps, even as Dalton and Petra come to my defense. Baptiste says he understands why I did it, and he's grateful that I was so anxious to reunite Summer with her parents. He's cutting me slack, being kind, while I see the worry in his eyes. In the end, all I can do is apologize, while Dalton insists that Cedra is in no actual danger.
We were very, very clear on the stipulations of the deal,
Dalton says.
We don't pay out until we see the baby's mother and confirm she hasn't been hurt. Yeah, Charisse is going to make Cedra spin us some bullshit story about how she went with Charisse voluntarily, but we know better. We'll get Cedra back and tell Charisse where she can stick her deal.
I would exercise more caution than that, Felicity says. I understand the impulse. I also want to punish Charisse for what she did.
But that's like punching a grizzly in the face,
Baptiste says.
Even if the grizzly doesn't come after you, it's going to strike at the first human it sees.
Felicity nods. She will find a way to punish Cedra and Baptiste for the loss of her reward. The young settlers exchange a look, acknowledgement of shared ground. I agree, I say. Ideally, we steal Cedra back from Charisse. If she figures it out and complains, we pay her off, as painful as that will be. And then we never, ever do business with her again. We have two choices here. Return to where Charisse and Owen snatched Cedra, or track the couple from here. Cedra and Baptiste's campsite is a kilometer away, and it seems likely that they brought Cedra back here before they broke camp. Dalton confirms that with the campfire. If they left last night, the coals would be cold by now. Also, it makes no sense to lie in wait for Cedra with all your gear on your back. Tracking them from here makes the most sense, especially when we know they'll head for Rockden with their booty. There's no reason to do otherwise. We split up, dividing our best trackers. Storm gets Petra and me, and Dalton takes Felicity and Baptiste. We head to the campsite first. If we had any doubt that Charisse and Owen are the couple who camped here, it disappears when Storm arrives. She's growling even before I ask her to snuffle the ground. When even dogs don't like you, that's a very bad sign, Petra says. I wait for her to make some comment on the fact that Storm likes her just fine, but Petra isn't so ham-handed. The implication dangles there, and she knows I'll see it. I snort my response and ask Storm to follow Charisse and Owen's trail. She grumbles at that, a growling sulk that tells me she really doesn't want another encounter with the traitor couple. I crouch in front of her and murmur reassurances, and she looks at me as if to say, "I hope you know what you're doing." Then she sets out. Our luck with using Storm as a tracking dog has been sporadic so far. Am I disappointed in that? Yes, I'll admit it. That's not her fault. While Newfoundlands are used in search and rescue, they aren't bloodhounds. Whatever Dalton's excuse for buying her, she really is a companion dog, and she's brilliant at that, an absolute joy in our lives. The fault may also be ours. We aren't dog trainers or trackers, and no amount of reading can fully overcome that. We've discussed sending her down south for professional training, and we might still do it. Yet she's still young, and when she can't find our quarry, it's not through lack of intelligence or commitment. It's the fault of challenging terrain. Today, though, Storm proves that she's a perfectly fine tracker, and the problem is that, too often, we've set her on the trail of people who know she'll come after them and use every trick for avoiding her. When it's someone who has no expectation of being tracked, finding them is puppy's play, and we have to hold her back from running along Charisse and Owen's trail. We get some dirty looks for that. Clearly, we should be able to keep up. Finally, I spot Owen, and I'm about to grab Storm's collar, realizing I lack an end-of-search signal. Another oversight on my part. Fortunately, she has no desire to get close to Owen, and she slows, glancing at me as if to say, "There he is. Can we go now?" We cannot. It's just Owen. He's sitting, well, crouching, actually, while performing a bodily function that Charisse obviously doesn't want to witness. As Petra sneaks up on Owen's other side, he finishes his business, rising with his hands on his pants, pulling them up. "Shit, that stinks," a voice says, and Petra and I go still. It's Charisse. I can't see her, but it's clearly her voice.
"Yeah, it stinks because it's shit," Owen says. "Yours doesn't smell like roses, babe."
"Cover it up," she says. He grumbles that this isn't their camp. They aren't sticking around. But he knocks snow over the steaming pile as he fastens his jeans. Petra looks at me. I gesture for Storm to stay, and then I begin to circle around to where I'll be able to see Charisse. Petra stays ducked behind a bush. After a few steps, I spot Charisse leaning against a tree. There's no sign of Cedra, but she must be nearby. I keep circling until I'm opposite the couple, and I can see everything around them. Trees and a few low bushes. Nothing big enough to hide Cedra. Both Owen and Charisse are armed, but the rifles are slung across their backs. I glance around for Dalton, but his group is long gone. I step out from my hiding spot. "Hey, guys." They both spin on me. I raise my hands. Owen reaches for his rifle, but I say, "Uh-uh. You go for yours and I go for mine, which is a lot more accessible." Their gazes go to my open parka, my gun right there, ready to draw. "Storm," I say. "Come, girl." She bounds from her hiding place. As she does, Petra appears 5 paces behind the couple, but they're busy watching the dog. Petra stops there, her gun out, and waits. "We hear you found the baby's mom," I say. Charisse's expression doesn't change. Her partner, however, sneaks a look her way, one that tells me what I've already suspected. "Let's trade now," I say. "You hand her over and collect your reward." Charisse snorts. "Since you obviously don't have the goods we were promised, we're not handing her over. We'll meet you at Rockden." "Sure. We can all go to Rockton. Together. We'll meet. The only reason for you to argue is if you don't have the mother. Yes, we don't, all right? We know who she is, we're on her trail, but we still need to talk to her. Talk, I say, brows rising. Why not just grab her and save yourself the trouble? Because someone put that into the terms of the damn agreement, she says, scowling at me. Did I misinterpret something? I sure as hell understood that we need to bring her to you of her own free will, which, yes, complicates things and... She looks from my gun to Storm and launches into a string of profanity.
Yeah, they fucked you over, babe,
Owen says. She shoots a lethal glare at him and then swings it on me. You did, didn't you? Set me on this girl's trail and then followed, waiting until I found my prey and then swooping in like a damn scavenger. I do all the work. You take the prize and then claim you owe me nothing. She steps forward. That was a stupid move, girl. And really, really. Stop right there, Petra says, as Storm growls. They both turn to see Petra, and I wince. Charisse hadn't gone for her gun. There was no reason for Petra to reveal herself. Yes, I brought backup, I say. And she's going to lower her gun right now, having realized Charisse is justifiably angry with me and not actually about to attack. Petra's expression says she doesn't appreciate taking orders from me. She still lowers the gun. If I did what you think, Charisse, you'd have every right to be pissed, I say. I did not. I'm following a separate lead directly from Rockton. I'm sure if we've been following you for the past 3 days, you'd know it. Now, do you have the baby's mother? Charisse throws up her hands and turns in a circle as if to say, do you see her? If we find that you kidnapped her? Oh, for fuck's sake, Charisse snaps. That's the kind of mistake this idiot would make. She waves at Owen, who only protests with a half-hearted, hey. When she looks at him, he flashes a grin and a shrug and says,
fair enough. Never claim to be the brains of the operation. You're with me for my pretty face. Not that I'm objecting, because you really like how I look and... I reap the benefits of your appreciation.
She rolls her eyes and then turns to me. I understand the terms of our deal. I also understand that there is no way in hell I'd get away with kidnapping that girl. She'd tattle the moment my back was turned. Also, I'd have to kick the kid's ass for ratting me out, and if you think I'd enjoy that, then you and I have a fundamental misunderstanding of one another. I wouldn't mind if I had to, but I'm not going to do it for fun. I have other ways to spend my time, more productive ways.
Like enjoying her husband's highly talented,
Owen begins. You done with the sales pitch? Charisse says. Owen's brows arch.
Sales pitch?
Casey doesn't want to fuck you. I know that comes as a tremendous shock, but I could write you a goddamn letter of recommendation and it wouldn't change her mind. Now stop embarrassing yourself. The blonde seems tough enough for you. Maybe she'd like a romp. With him? Petra says. Ha! No thanks. However, if you're offering... Petra's trying to throw Charisse off balance, shock her. But Charisse only barks a laugh and says, not on the table, sugar. Not right now, anyway. I'm busy negotiating with your friend here. She turns to me. I don't have the girl. I notice you aren't naming her. Neither am I. We're both covering our asses in case the other has mistakenly identified the target. I don't have her. I'm on her trail, though. I was given bad information on her exact whereabouts, but I spotted her this morning. Unfortunately, they were on the other side of the river, which isn't fully frozen, so I couldn't cross there and talk to them. I picked up the trail, and I thought we were getting close when my darling husband needed to take a shit.
I had cramps.
And now we're further delayed. Also, we're no longer the only ones tracking her. So here's my offer, Miss Casey. You can give me half the reward for finding her and setting you on the proper trail. Or we race to the finish line. But if we get to her first, I expect the full reward. Or I will take her captive until I get it. Petra balks, pointing out that we know who the target is and Charisse didn't find her. Yet Charisse did find out who Abby's mother is, independent of us. And unlike us, she knows where to pick up the trail. Also, as far as I'm concerned, if half the reward means Owen and Charisse fade into the forest without interfering, it's worth it. So I agree. You said they, I say. She wasn't alone. You saw her with someone this morning? Yep, her and her husband out looking for their little one. Petra's gaze cuts my way, but I pretend not to see it. So you saw this girl, Sidra? Yes, I saw Sidra. And some guy, her guy, Baptiste. I saw Sidra and Baptiste across the river this morning, and I'd strongly suggest that you set your pup on their trail because that sky says snow, and their trail isn't going to last. Chapter 40. Charisse shows us the trail, and I put Storm on it. The trail is a mess, and I can't help but wonder if we're being tricked. Whoever walked this way is following in the tracks left by a herd of caribou. The temperature is rising, and it's got to be above freezing. The sun beating down on a trail through relatively open land. Meaning not only are the human prints almost lost among the caribou ones, but they're all melting into mush. And then it starts to snow, almost as if Charisse called for the skies to open and make it even more impossible to confirm her story. Here, she says, pointing at a clear footprint. And before you say that's mine, she puts her own foot beside it. Hers are about a size bigger. I don't trust Charisse, but she plays the long game. Looking into the future and setting out her pieces for the moves that will ultimately benefit her rather than the ones that'll fill her pocket at this moment. It's not in her interests to trick us for one reward when she might be able to parlay this transaction into a long-term relationship. They leave, and I set Storm on that print, the only one I'm relatively sure comes from Sidra. She snuffles around a bit. Once she's confident, she starts tracking. He lied, Petra says. That son of a bitch Baptiste lied. I don't know how you bought his story, Casey. I'm sorry, but that was dead obvious. First, his kid is kidnapped, and then his wife? Not even by the same person? I'll tell you what happened. That hostile woman, Ellen, took Abby for good reason. Those two kids abandoned the baby, or they were talking about it, and they were just shitty parents. Ellen took Abby and ran. They caught up and shot her and left their own baby to die in the forest. I glance over at her. That's all I do. Heat rises in her face, and then her jaw sets. Yes, I find it hard to believe any parent would do that, but as a cop, you know it happens. Even more likely, it was just him. My ex was the maternal one in our relationship. Maternal in the traditional, ignorant sense that women are the real parents and the guys are just sperm donors and bottomless wallets. That's how men are raised. My ex grew up sneaking his sister's dolls to play with. If his parents caught him, they took them away, terrified it meant he was gay. That's what we do to little boys, and we do the opposite to little girls who don't want dolls. The result is that mom usually is the maternal one, the protective one. How many family annihilators are women? A few, I say. But yes, they're overwhelmingly men. Your point being, I presume, that you think Baptiste didn't want this baby. So he tried to get rid of her, shot Ellen, and is now leading us on a wild goose chase after a fictional kidnapper. You saw his gun. Does it match the murder weapon? Yes. Yet you still think the kid's telling the truth, and Charisse is lying about seeing them together this morning. No, I don't think Charisse is lying. Mistaken, then? I'm not sure. She grumbles at that. An idea is forming in my brain. It's been there since Charisse mentioned seeing Baptiste and Sidra across the river, and my gut screamed that she was wrong. Not lying, just mistaken. My brain demanded and then supplied an alternate explanation, and berated me for not asking more questions while I had Felicity and Baptiste here. Simple questions, easily answered, and yet I didn't ask, because they didn't seem germane to what was happening. Baptiste or Felicity could tell me what I need to know. I also want to find Dalton to bounce this theory off him. He didn't hear our voices and come running while we were talking to Charisse. That bothers me, and I'm trying very hard not to freak out over it and shout for him. That would risk tipping off others in the forest. I must trust that Dalton is fine. I could be wrong about Baptiste. If I am, then that may answer my "where are they?" question. My only consolation is that I haven't heard a shotgun blast, which doesn't keep me from wishing we'd kept the damned weapon we'd taken from Baptiste. After another half kilometer, I can't silence that fretting anymore. We might be hot on Cedra's trail, but we need to reunite with the others. Petra agrees. I'll play signpost to mark the trail, she says. You take the pup and go find Eric. I set out with Storm. I've told her to find Dalton, and I'm hoping she'll catch his scent on the breeze. We walk through unbroken snow wherever possible, leaving breadcrumbs back to Petra. It's less than 10 minutes before Storm goes still. She sniffs the air. It's not Dalton. If it were, she'd veer that way without hesitation. Who is it, girl? Her body language is relaxed, meaning whoever it is doesn't worry her. Not Charisse and Owen, then. It's a scent she recognizes, though. Someone she has no strong feelings about either way. She glances at me, and there's question in that look. It suggests she's smelling another member of our party, Felicity or Baptiste. And while they aren't her target, perhaps I'm also looking for them? Good girl, I say. Then I tell her, yes, please track the new scent. I'm not sure she'll understand my command, but she sets off at a lope. I take out my gun. I must, in case this is Baptiste and I am mistaken about him. We head into thick forest and I slow Storm, only to get a look that says we're too close to the target to bother. Yet despite the thick forest, I don't see anyone. Storm stops. She goes rigid and whines, anxiety strumming from her. I look around. There's no one here, no place for anyone to hide. What is it, girl? I follow her gaze. Just ahead, snow has been flattened. I see prints, multiple sets. That's when I spot the blood, drops of red sunk into the snow. I race over. There's blood, definite blood, recently sprayed, droplets falling into fresh snow. Under my feet, the snow isn't just trampled, it's flat. Someone fell here, a struggle on the ground, a blow, blood flying. Two sets of prints coming from opposite directions, one significantly smaller than the other. Felicity's prints. I recognize the imprint of fur around the edge. The other set is male, not Dalton's boots. That's all I can tell. His prints would be instantly distinguishable from the tread-free ones. Felicity was here. Someone attacked her. Or she attacked someone. If it was Felicity attacking, though, she lost. I see the male prince leaving the flattened snow of the fight and dragging something with him. Dragging Felicity. I'm following that trail when Storm whines. Not the anxiety of smelling blood, though. This is excitement. Her nose goes up and her entire body wriggles with the joy that can only mean one thing. Eric, I say. Do you smell Eric? She woofs. A deep adult Newfoundland woof, even as her massive body puppy gyrates with excitement. Good girl! I glance at the trail where someone dragged Felicity away. Is leaving it to go after Dalton the right move?
Stop right there!
A voice shouts. Baptiste's voice, ringing through the forest, coming from the direction Storm is looking. From Dalton's direction. A shotgun blast, and I'm running, running as fast as I can. I hear Dalton's voice then. Thank God I hear Dalton's voice, even if it barely pierces the blood pounding in my ears. He's saying something I can't catch. His voice calm, and Baptiste shouts at him again, telling him to get back. Get back right now. Get away from her. Her? Felicity? Cedra? Either way, my gut drops. I've made a mistake, an unforgivable one. Charisse said she saw Baptiste with Cedra after Cedra was supposedly kidnapped. Petra jumped to the obvious conclusion. Baptiste was lying, but I'd wanted to believe otherwise. Yes, there's a selfish part of me that wants Abby's parents to be horrible people who do not deserve her so I can keep her. But there's another part I only recognize now, the part that wants the best of all possible endings to this story by that little baby getting back to loving and capable parents.
I want her to have good parents who love each other and love her and are beside themselves with panic at her disappearance. That's the part that decided Baptiste isn't guilty. Not Baptiste and not Cedra. Neither of them killed Ellen. Neither of them got rid of their baby. Neither of them planned this fake kidnapping to get rid of us. They might be young and naive, but they are good and honest, and they deserve their little girl back. That is who I want them to be. Then I hear Baptiste telling Dalton to get away from her, and I realize I'm wrong. As I work this through, I run. I don't stop running. Then I hear a woman's voice say, "Put the gun down, you son of a bitch!" And I'm so caught up in my thoughts that I think it must be Cedra talking to Dalton, and this means she is just as culpable. No, it's not Cedra. My mind replays the voice, and there is no question who I'm hearing, even before Petra says, "Lower that damn shotgun, or I put a bullet through your lying bastard head, boy." I see Dalton now, just ahead. Others are with him, but they're only meaningless figures until I found Dalton and confirmed he's on his feet, apparently unharmed.
"Petra, no," Dalton says. "Everyone just hold on."
I burst through the trees. The shotgun barrel turns on me. Petra barks, "Don't you dare," echoed by Dalton as he pulls his own gun, swinging it on Baptiste. Then we all freeze, guns pointing everywhere, and a voice says, "Stop! Everyone, please, stop!" It's a girl's voice, high and tight with fear. I follow it to a stranger, rising from the ground near Dalton as she claws off a gag. A girl no bigger than me, with long black curls. She staggers in front of Dalton, and Petra snaps, "Stop right there!" But Cedra ignores her. Cedra makes it to her husband, and he nearly drops the gun in his lunge to catch her. The muzzle is down, thankfully, and Petra doesn't fire as Baptiste grabs Cedra and the shotgun slides to the ground beside them.
"Put the gun down," Dalton says to Petra. "Everything's fine."
"Everything is not fine," she says. "These two tricked—"
"No one tricked anyone," Dalton says. "I found Cedra. I was freeing her when Baptiste showed up, and he misinterpreted." "Cedra, did I kidnap you?"
She shakes her head.
"He was helping me, Baptiste."
"Did Baptiste kidnap you?"
I ask. Her eyes round.
"Of course not. I don't know who did it. Someone grabbed me at the camp and put something over my eyes."
"Then how do you know it wasn't Baptiste?"
Petra asks. Cedra's eyes flash.
"I do not need to see my husband to know him. It was a man, I'm sure of that. He spoke to me, but his voice was distorted. We were walking, but he kept stopping, and he'd tie me up. Then he'd leave and come back. He'd left me again when this man found me and said he was from Rockton and he was with you, Baptiste."
"He is," I say. "Your husband just panicked." I turn to Baptiste. "Have you ever lent Lane your shotgun?" His face screws up as if he's misheard. "Lane from the second?"
"Yes, I know Lane,"
he says impatiently.
"He is my friend, and yes, I have loaned him our shotgun, but I don't understand."
"That's the gun that was used to kill Ellen." "I don't know that for certain, of course, but they'll never realize that." "Someone?"
"No,"
Cedra says, and she wheels. And I think she's spinning on me to deny it, but instead she faces the forest and shouts, "Lane!"
That's,
Baptiste blinks, looking lost.
"Lane wouldn't—"
He trails off, unable to finish. Then he looks at me.
This gun was used—
"To kill Ellen,"
Cedra says, and tears glisten in her eyes as she looks at me.
"That's what you said, isn't it? Ellen is dead and Lane killed her. He killed her and came for me. Killed her and stole.
She spins to face the forest again, and when she screams,
"Lane!"
It's a raw and horrible sound, and the force of it buckles her knees. Baptiste catches her, his face still blank with shock. I see his face, and I see hers, and the missing piece falls into place. Motivation.
Felicity said four kids from the two settlements hung out together. Tomas said Lane lost his best friend last year. That connection had clicked earlier. Lane knew Cedra and Baptiste was his supposedly dead friend. I hadn't confirmed that because it seemed nothing more than a tragic collision of circumstance. Lane knows Ellen. Lane also knows Baptiste and Cedra. A hostile steals their baby, and Ellen steals her back, and Lane sees her and shoots her because she's having an affair with his aunt. He has no idea she's clutching a baby under her parka. And the fact that that baby belongs to his old friends? Tragic, tragic coincidence. That makes sense, right? And if the gun that murdered Ellen belongs to Baptiste, then that must mean Baptiste or Cedra actually shot her. The young couple have been trading their game with Lane, who's been passing it off as his own arrow shot kills. Then, when we accuse Lane of shooting Ellen with that same gun, he realizes who actually did it and quickly spins a story to protect his friends. That must be the answer, right? Unless Cherie sees Cedra with a young man she presumes is Baptiste, while my gut says Baptiste didn't lie to us and his wife is missing. Who else could Cherie mistake for Baptiste? Another young, dark-haired man of similar build? Lane. Before this moment, I could only guess at why Lane kidnapped Cedra. Maybe he confessed to her, and she hadn't forgiven him. Or maybe he took her hostage as a bargaining chip against his punishment for killing Ellen. Neither scenario had satisfied me. Now, in Cedra's scream of rage and frustration, I hear the echoes of other women, and I see the answer.
Lane,
Baptiste says, looking at me as he holds Cedra, who vibrates with fury.
You think Lane?
He confessed to killing Ellen, I say. He didn't seem to know she was holding Summer when she died.
Holding?
Cedra says.
Summer is safe,
Baptiste says quickly.
This woman, Casey, found her, and she's fine. Ellen had rescued her, and she died holding her, but they found Summer before anything could.
Lane murdered Ellen,
Cedra stares at me.
While she was holding my baby. He left her.
He didn't seem to know, I say. Her face contorts in an inhuman snarl.
Oh, he knew. He knew.
She turns and screams.
Lane! Show yourself, you coward! You want me so badly? Come and face me!
What?
Baptiste looks sick.
No. Yes, at first, yes, but he said he was over you. He said he was happy for us.
He lied,
Cedra spits, face contorting again.
He lied to you. Not to me, though. Never to me. It didn't matter what I said. It didn't matter what I did.
He kept.
Baptiste sways, face green.
He kept bothering you, and you never told me.
He was your friend, and I thought he'd get over it. He would see the truth that it was you and it had always been you, and I never saw him as anything but a friend. I married you. I had your baby. He would understand soon. I kept telling myself he would finally understand, and he did not.
Baptiste goes still, processing. Then his face hardens and he strides toward the forest.
Lane! Cedra's right! Show yourself! You have something to say to me, come out here and—
A whistle. That's all I hear. An odd whistle. And then Baptiste falls back and Cedra screams. She runs to her husband as he staggers back, an arrow in his shoulder. Cedra knocks Baptiste to the ground as another arrow whistles past. She covers his body, protecting him as we surround them, guns out, shouting for Lane. The forest goes silent. Dalton motions that he's heading in. I clamp down on the urge to stop him. Instead, I motion that I'll do the same from the other side, and he gives me the same look, the one that resists saying, no, don't go. Go or stay, though, we're in equal danger from an archer in the woods. Dalton leaves first, as I call to Storm, loud enough to distract Lane if he's watching. I'm telling Storm to stay with Petra when Cedra shouts, "Lane!" I look to see Cedra marching toward the forest, her arms spread wide. Petra is on the ground with Baptiste, checking his shoulder injury. Baptiste stares at Cedra and then tries to rise, but Petra holds him down.
"Cedra,"
I say,
"don't."
"Lane!" she shouts.
"I do not love you. You could take me captive and I would only kill you the first chance I got. If I couldn't kill you, I would kill myself before I let you touch me. Is that clear? Do you understand? I will not be yours. I will never."
"No," I say. I hear her words and I hear echoes of others and I know what is coming, what is always coming in a situation like this. I run for Cedra, but Petra is closer, and she knows the same thing I do. She's on her feet, launching herself at Cedra. That whistle sounds, that horrible whistle. Petra hits Cedra and sends her flying, and the arrow hits Petra in the chest. I'm already running at her, and I see it hit, and her eyes round, mouth rounding too, in surprise. Another arrow, this one hitting her in the shoulder, spinning her. She stumbles, and I catch her. I grab her, and her feet scuffle against the ground as she tries to stay upright.
"Cover!"
I shout at Cedra and Baptiste.
"Get to cover! Storm!"
Storm races to me as I half-drag Petra. Baptiste says,
"Here!"
And I look to him and Cedra ducking behind a deadfall off to our left. I manage to get Petra there. I glance at Baptiste, but he says,
"I'm fine."
"He's not fine," Cedra says, voice quavering. "But his jacket is thick. He'll be all right."
Cedra helps me lay Petra down. Petra's fingers wrap around my arm, her face pale, eyes wide with impending shock.
"You're okay," I say.
"Relax.
Stay with us."
"Emily,"
she says. And it takes me a moment to remember that that's her grandmother, one of the board members for Rockton.
The hostels. Your theory.
Tell Emily my theory about the hostiles.
"Got it. But you can do it yourself. Just hold on."
We don't remove the arrows, not until we get a look at how deep they're in. I undo Petra's parka. While she hasn't been as lucky as Baptiste, the arrowheads haven't gone deeper than the head. One is in her shoulder, the other just above her heart. Serious? Yes. Life-threatening, though? Oh, I hope not. I really, really hope not. I can't see well enough to be sure, not without removing the arrows.
"We need to snap off the shafts," I say. "If the shafts are off, we can get her out of that jacket and—"
"Eric," Petra whispers. "Go look after Eric. And get this guy. Stop him."
I hesitate, but Cedra shoulders me aside, taking over.
"She's right. We'll leave the arrows in for now. Just find your sheriff and stop Lane."
She meets my gaze.
"Please stop Lane."
I nod, squeeze Petra's hand, and then take off. Chapter 41. From the arrow fire, I know the direction to go. I do what we'd planned before Petra got shot. I sneak up in the other direction, presumably on Lane's opposite side. I hear Lane before I see him. He's breathing hard and fast, the sound pulling me easily through the woods, letting me approach alongside him, no danger of running smack into him. Not that I'm too worried about that. His weapon might be lethal, but he doesn't have an arrow knocked. I can see that as soon as I spot him. He's poised, bow in hand, his gaze riveted on the place where the others hide behind the deadfall. He's waiting for movement. I don't know what he expects, someone to leap up like a jack-in-the-box. His heavy breathing tells me his adrenaline is pumping, blood pounding in his ears, rendering him deaf and blind to everything except what he wants to see. Cedra. He's waiting for Cedra. He expects she'll leap up again to scream at him. Tell him that she'll never be his, and he will kill her for it. That is what men like him do. He's been raised to believe he has the right to a life partner, the right to the woman he chooses to fill that role, and if he can't have her, then by God, no one else will either. He'll kill Cedra and then himself. That is how this goes. It's how it always goes. So Lane waits for his chance, and he doesn't hear me creep up on his left side. He hasn't seen the figure to his right either. Dalton will have heard the commotion with Petra going down, and he'll have paused long enough to be sure we were safely undercover. Then he came here, where he'll wait to see what I do before he makes his move. When I'm far enough behind Lane's peripheral vision, I lean out and catch Dalton's eye. He nods and motions a plan. Or I'm sure it's a plan, but we're 40 feet apart in the forest, and it's not as if I see more than a few hand gestures. That's enough, though. I know what we should do, and it seems to coincide with what he's suggesting. We both creep toward Lane from our respective positions, staying out of visual range and on either side of him. Then, without warning, Dalton steps forward, plowing through brush, winter dry twigs crackling. Lane wheels on Dalton, and that's apparently my cue to swing behind him and cut off his escape route. I dart into place just as Lane looks over his shoulder to find me there, gun pointed at him, Dalton doing the same on his other side. "If you reach for an arrow, we fire," I say. "You can run, but this time we're close enough to catch you." "Also close enough to shoot you," Dalton says. "Save ourselves the trouble of chasing." "I'm fine with shooting," I say. "In fact, I'd say it might be our best option. Our only option, really." "You stole a baby. You murdered Ellen. You hoped to murder the baby with her. Now you're trying to murder your best friend and the woman you supposedly love."
"Seems to me he doesn't know the meaning of that word,"
Dalton drawls. Lane's face purples.
"I'm the only one who does know the meaning of it. Baptiste doesn't. He's no friend of mine. Friends don't do that."
"Friends don't fall in love with the girl you like," I say. "The girl who likes them back?"
"I found her," he says. "Not him, me. I met Cedra and Felicity in the forest hunting duck. I was their friend first, and then I brought Baptiste to meet them. I would get Cedra and he'd get Felicity. He knew that. I found them first, so I was entitled to first pick."
"Yeah," Dalton says.
"Like when you're hunting and you spot a herd of caribou. If you spot them first and bring your friend, you should get first shot. First pick of the herd. That's how it works. And if he shoots first, he's an asshole."
Lane straightens.
"Yes, you understand." "I understand if it's a herd of caribou," Dalton says. "But those were girls, human beings, not game animals. You can tell Baptiste you like Cedra, and if he's a decent friend, he won't make a play for her if there's a chance she feels the same about you, but that isn't how it went, was it?"
Lane shoots Dalton a look I can't see. "Cedra fell for Baptiste," I say, "and he fell for her. He probably felt lousy about it, but from what I understand, you stood down. You told Baptiste it was fine, while you kept pursuing Cedra. She ran away with him, and you did what? Offered to help them? Bring their game to the second settlement in trade? Felicity backed off, but you stuck close in hopes of winning Cedra. Then along came a baby, and you couldn't allow that. You took Summer. Stole her."
"I had to," he snarls. "A winter baby? How could Baptiste do that to Cedra?
It proved he didn't care about her.
I did what needed to be done."
"Taking their baby and giving it to the hostiles?" His jaw sets.
"I gave it to a wild woman who wanted a child. I heard Ellen mention the woman, and I knew that was the answer. I left the baby where the woman went to get water each morning, and she took her. She was happy to take her. Then Ellen showed up and stole her back. I'd been out hunting with Baptiste's gun. As I headed home, I heard the baby and I heard Ellen hushing her. I found them. I told Ellen to give me the baby, but she said no. She'd been hit on the head stealing her from the hostile woman and she was confused. She ran and I fired and she kept running."
"So you let her go," I say. He doesn't answer. "No, you didn't," I say. "You followed enough to see her lying down. She stopped to rest. Between the head injury and the shot, she was losing blood and confused, and she'd lain down to rest. And you left her there,
You left her to die in the snow. You left the baby to die with her.
I did it for her, he snarls. For Cedra. To save her from him.
For 14 years, I have worried that someday, holding a gun in my hand, I will repeat the mistake I made with Blaine. Someone will say something and the rage, the absolute rage I felt then, will rise again. And my gun will rise too. And I will pull the trigger. For 14 years, that possibility has terrified me. And now, in this split second, it evaporates. I feel that rage again, a blind wave of it washing over me. I see Ellen lying in the snow, a woman who only wanted to help. I see Ellen dead with Summer in her arms, and I think of how close that baby came to dying horribly in the snow, and all this time I've told myself it was a mistake. It had to be, didn't it? No one would do that on purpose. Before me stands the boy who did it. On purpose. Murdered a kind and generous woman. Abandoned a baby to the elements. And for what? For a girl who never gave him a moment's encouragement. To murder her child, destroy her life, and then try to kill her if he couldn't have her? Lane deserves my bullet more than Blaine Sartori ever did. He may even deserve it more than Val did. But I do not pull the trigger because I can control that impulse. The situation is under control, and we are in no immediate danger, and I cannot execute Lane for his crimes. That is not my place. I know my place. I understand it, and I will never make that mistake again. Lane, I say. You are under arrest for the murder of Ellen and the attempted murder of Summer and Cedra and Baptiste. You will appear before a joint committee of the first and second settlements who will determine your punishment. He runs at Dalton. I still don't fire. My finger moves to the trigger and I shout at him to stop, but I don't need to shoot. Lane is a man with a bow in his hand, the arrows still in their quiver, and he's running at a law enforcement officer with a gun. Dalton doesn't shoot either. When Lane draws near, he kicks, his foot connecting with a crack. The young man drops to one knee, and Dalton backs up, gun still aimed.
Shoot me, Lane says. I'm not,
Dalton begins.
You're going to have to, because I won't stop. If you let me live, I'll never stop. I'll find a way to kill Baptiste, kill that baby, and if Cedra won't come with me, then I'll kill her too. She's mine, mine! I will kill everyone who comes between me and her, and then I'll take her and—
A figure rushes from the forest. It's a blur. That's all I see. A blur of motion, and I spin on it, my gun raised as it rushes Lane. The blur leaps on him, and only then do I see a face. A face not contorted in rage, but ice cold with it. It's Felicity. Her hand flies up as I shout at her to get back, and as that hand rises, I see the blade in it. A blade already bloodstained, droplets flecking the snow. The blade falls again, slamming into Lane's back, and I shout at her to stop, but I do not stop her. I know my place, and it is not my place to stop her. Only when she falls back, breathing hard, her hands clutching the bloody knife, does Dalton run over and pull her back. Lane falls face first to the snow. Felicity drops the knife and then wrenches from Dalton's grip. He lets her go. She walks over and drops to her knees beside Lane.
You should have killed me while you had the chance, she says. But that was always your mistake. You underestimated me, underestimated Cedra. We made that mistake too. We underestimated you.
She leans down to his ear, her voice a hoarse whisper as she says,
Not this time. I did not underestimate you this time, Lane.
She stays there at his side until he breathes his last. Chapter 42. There's no time to process what has happened, no time to help Felicity process it. And I know from experience that will not happen immediately. She's done what she needed to do to protect her friend. Later, the doubts and second guessing will come, and I don't know whether she'll let me help with that.
but I will if I can. Right now, our biggest concern is Petra. She has an arrow in her chest, and we are hours from Rockton. Dalton runs ahead to bring help and motorized transport. While he's gone, we fashion a stretcher for Petra. Storm pulls it, and Cedra and I help. While Baptiste and Felicity try to do their part, both are injured. Baptiste with a minor shoulder wound and Felicity with a head injury, inflicted when Lane found her in the forest. Their job is to walk behind the sled and make sure Petra stays awake and lucid. We've been walking for almost 2 hours when I hear the whine of a snowmobile and the rumble of the ATV. Dalton cuts through brush on the snowmobile and then takes over the stretcher, guiding it through to where the ATV waits on a wider path. Dalton sends me in the ATV with Cedra. I know why he picks her to go. He doesn't need to say it, but I know. After he sets Petra up for the ride, he stays behind with Anders to get the rest of the group to Rockton. I drive the ATV as fast as I dare through the well-packed snow of the main trail. Cedra doesn't clutch the grab handles for dear life. She stares straight ahead, her face drawn, her mind already at our destination and what waits there. I drive the ATV straight into town. April waits on the clinic stairs, Diana with her to help, several of the men ready to carry Petra inside. And as we pull to a halt, another figure appears from inside the clinic. Jen, holding a baby-sized bundle to her chest. Cedra is out of the ATV before it stops. She stumbles forward, tripping over her feet and nearly falling in her scramble to get to her baby. Jen descends the stairs and meets her, holding Summer out. Cedra doesn't take her. She wobbles there and then collapses to her knees, crying in relief. And Jen bends in front of her, letting Cedra take the baby there, kneeling in the snow. I turn away from the scene and help the men with Petra. It's morning, early morning, not yet light. I'm beside Petra's bed in the clinic. She's stable. The arrow entered above her heart, piercing less than an inch. She's lost a lot of blood and she'll need time to recover, but she's all right, sleeping soundly as I keep watch. I've been here all night, not leaving the clinic since I arrived. Hiding here? Yes, I have the self-awareness to admit that. April needed me and I wanted to be here for Petra, but it also gave me the excuse not to face the joyous parent and child reunion. I slept here in this chair. In the night, I woke to find Dalton in a chair beside me, a blanket draped over us. When I wake again at 6:30, he's already gone, and I feel the regret of that. But I feel something else, too. Relief. I'm not ready to face him. I need time to process this and grieve on my own. And as soon as that thought comes, another follows it. A realization that has my cheeks flaming and my ass out of that chair in a heartbeat. I check Petra. Then I hurry out to see Kenny walking past, and I ask him to step in and watch Petra for me. "Actually, I was just coming for you," he says. "The kids are leaving soon, and they really want to see you first." I hesitate, which is a shitty and selfish thing to do, and I am ashamed to admit it. I'm also snared between two sources of shame. The one that wants to flee any last moments with Summer, and the one that needs to talk to Dalton. I should speak to Eric first, I say. Is he around? He's with the boy, Baptiste. They're talking, and Cedra wanted to bring the baby over to speak to you alone before they go. I hesitate again, that childish impulse filling me, the impulse to lie and say I cannot see her. Nope, sorry, terribly, terribly busy. I squash it and say, "Of course, send her over to the house and let Eric know we're there." "Before you go," he says, "the hot tub is ready." "Where?" "Later," I say. "We'll talk later." But it's, his voice trails off as I hurry away. As I walk through town, I hear carols and look over to see a group of people singing. I check my watch. Yep, it's 7 in the morning. What the hell are people? That's when I see the date on my watch. December 21st. That's what Kenny meant. It's winter solstice, the biggest celebration of our year, and I could not feel less festive. I duck around the carolers and hurry to our house. I'm opening our front door when Cedra appears. I hold it for her, and I smile, and I hope that smile looks every bit as genuine as she deserves. Because she does deserve it. This is her baby. She was, from what I can tell, a perfect mother, despite her youth. She spent the 10 days frantically trying to find her lost child. She confronted a killer to protect her family. And if there was any doubt about how much she loved Summer, it could not survive witnessing that heart-wrenching reunion scene last night. So I smile for her, and it damned well better be a good one, or I will not forgive myself for my petty jealousy. I usher her in, and I'm about to apologize for the cold when I see that Dalton has laid the fire, in case I come back here. Thoughtful and considerate as always. Which only twists the knife that reminds me I have not been the same to him these last few hours. I start the kettle for coffee, mostly as busy work while she settles in with the baby. Her baby, not mine. Never mine.
I can't thank you enough for what you did, she says. Even saying thank you feels like such an understatement. But I don't know what else to say.
I'm not sure how to reply to that. It was nothing, really. Any decent person would have done the same. It was no trouble at all. Platitudes. And like her, I don't want to say them. They feel empty. So I only say, "You're welcome." Then I turn, and she rises, holding out the baby. And I know she doesn't realize what that gesture means to me, how it is a knife in my gut. She is only being kind. So I must accept that kindness and accept Summer and sink stiffly onto the chair, holding the baby and trying not to look down at her. Summer fusses, and I tell myself she doesn't know I'm not looking at her. Her eyes can't focus enough to find mine, but my gut calls me a coward. And I look down. Our eyes meet, and her lips purse, the way they do when she's considering whether to cry. And I'm almost hoping she will. Whoops, ha ha, guess she wants her mommy. Better take her back. Summer sucks her lips twice, as if considering. Then her nostrils flare, and it is as if she catches my scent, finally realizes it's me. And she snuggles down, and my heart cracks. I feel it crack, and I feel the tears well, and I blink hard, clearing my throat. Have you given any thought to what Felicity offered last night? I say, spending the winter with the first settlement. I know you left because you didn't think they'd let you be with Baptiste, but you have a baby now. They won't separate your new family.
Thank you, and yes, we're doing that, only for the winter. We do want to be on our own.
We could use help, though. Support and trade partners, and if either settlement will offer that, we'll take it. If you have any problems, come back here, I say. I'm sure you'll be fine on your own once you're settled and the baby's a little older, but I'd strongly advise spending this winter in the settlement. Or here, if they won't take you.
And if they do take us,
she raises her eyes to mine, suddenly shy.
May we still visit?
Of course. The door opens. Dalton and Baptiste enter, kicking snow off their boots. I hold Summer out to Cedra, but she motions for Baptiste to take her, teasing him when Summer fusses at his cold touch. I watch the three of them, and yes, my heart cracks a little more, but it swells too. They are in love with each other and with their baby, and no child can truly hope for more.
Did you ask her?
Baptiste says to Cedra. Cedra shakes her head and looks at me.
We named her Summer as a joke. Not a very good joke, either. But we'd like, if it's all right with you, to change that. We'd like to call her Casey.
I swallow. That's very kind. It isn't necessary, though, and I think she should have her own name. Summer is good. I force a too bright smile. And it'd be less confusing when you come to visit. I am honored, though, truly honored.
Eric thought you'd say that,
Baptiste says with a smile.
so Cedra and I have a backup plan. We heard you called her Abby here after a young woman who died. May we keep calling her that?
I glance at Dalton. He nods. Yes, I say. That would be lovely. Thank you.
We even have a toy our Abby brought to Rockton,
Dalton says.
It's butt ugly, but it meant a lot to her, and there's no family to give it back to. That and a necklace. You're welcome to take those. You can tell her about the girl she was named after.
Cedra's face glows. Are you sure?
We're sure.
That would be wonderful. Thank you. Cedra, Baptiste, and Abby are gone. It doesn't matter that I never met Abigail. The joy of handing over her toy and necklace will stay with me for a long time. They will be treasured, as they deserve to be. Giving her name to this baby is even more satisfying, not only to honor the girl who first carried it, but because, in an odd way, it helps me, as if something of the baby's visit here remains with her, even as she leaves. Dalton and Storm walk with them for a bit. While they're gone, I hurry out to tell Kenny where I want the hot tub and ask if they can set it up later while I distract Dalton. I swing by the bakery and grab 2 dozen holiday cookies before they open their doors to the waiting line. I hand out the 1st dozen to those waiting, promise I'll see them all tonight at the big bonfire celebration. Then I go home. The moment Dalton walks into the house, I say, I am so sorry.
For what?
He says as he walks into the living room where I'm waiting with coffee and cookies. Being a complete and utter selfish bitch. I avoided you last night because I was dealing with Abby leaving. But I'm not the only one affected, and I ignored that. I made it all about me. It wasn't. He sinks onto the sofa and tugs me down beside him.
I understood. And I think it was harder for you. You bonded with her. Me?
He tilts his head.
I'd have kept her. Happily kept her. But for me, she was more of a...
He purses his lips.
She was a glimpse of something else. A vision of a possibility I never really considered. Not just a baby, but a baby with you. A family that's more than you and me. After having Abby here, yeah, I can see that for us. And I think I want it. Except...
He goes quiet, uncomfortably quiet, scratching at his beard. Go on. He sneaks a peek my way. Eric? Talk. Tell me what you're thinking. If what you want isn't what I want, we'll discuss that. I'd never hold it against you.
I like the vision I saw,
he says.
If Abby needed a father, I'd be that for her. But since she doesn't, I'm in no hurry.
Another glance snuck my way.
I'm not sure I'm ready to share you just yet.
And I am thrilled to hear that, because I'm not ready to share you either. As much as I loved seeing you with Abby, part of me wants you all to myself for a little longer. He nods. It's not the decisive nod I expect, though, and I say, there's more, isn't there?
Not about this. Yeah, I'd like a kid someday, but...
Yeah, I want more time with just us.
Seeing Cedra and Baptiste, though.
A deep breath.
It brought back a lot of memories. They reminded me of my parents. Memories of them I didn't even think I still had. How they looked at each other. How they looked at Jacob. How they looked at...
Another scratch of his beard as he shrugs. How they looked at you. He nods.
Those kids and that baby. They're a family. And I had that kind of family.
A lot of hope, I say. A lot of love. His eyes glisten and he blinks hard with a thick.
Yeah. I need to face that. Remember it. Deal with it.
He looks at me.
Talk about it.
I'm here whenever you're ready.
I'm ready,
he says.
Maybe not for a baby, but I'm ready for this.
Then I'm ready to listen. This is Therese Plummer. We hope you've enjoyed Alone in the Wild, a Macmillan audio production from Minotaur Books. This title was produced by Tom Meese. Text copyright 2020 by KLA Frick, Inc. Production copyright 2020 by Macmillan Audio. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.